Chapter 11. Aunt Beast. "No," Mr. Merry said sharply. "Please put her down." A sense of amusement seemed to emanate from the beasts. The tallest, who seemed to be the spokesman, said, "We frighten you?" "What are you going to do with us?" Mr. Merry asked. The beast said, "I'm sorry, we communicate better with the other one." He turned toward Calvin.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Calvin O'Keefe." "What's that?"
"I'm a boy,
a young man."
"You two are afraid?"
"I'm not sure."
"Tell me," the beast says, "what do you suppose you'd do if three of us suddenly arrived on your home planet?"
"Shoot you, I guess," Calvin admitted.
"Then isn't that what we should do with you?" Calvin's freckles seemed to deepen, but he answered quietly, "I'd really rather you didn't. I mean, the Earth's my home, and I'd rather be there than anywhere in the world. I mean, the universe. And I can't wait to get back, but we make some awful bloopers there."
The smallest beast, the one holding Meg, said, "And perhaps they aren't used to visitors from other planets."
"Used to it," Calvin explained. "We've never had any, as far as I know."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
The middle beast, a tremor of trepidation in his words, said, "You aren't from a dark planet, are you?"
"No."
Calvin shook his head firmly through the beast couldn't see him. We're shadowed, but we're fighting the shadow." The beast holding Meg questioned,
"You three are fighting?"
"Yes," Calvin answered. "Now that we know about it." The tall one turned back to Mr. Murray, speaking sternly. "You, the oldest man, from where have you come now?" Mr. Murray answered steadily, "From a planet called Camazotz." There was a mutter from the three beasts. "We do not belong there," Mr. Murray said slowly and distinctly. "We were strangers there as we are here. I was a prisoner there, and these children rescued me. My youngest son, my baby, is still there, trapped in the dark mind of it." Meg tried to twist around in the beast's arms to glare at her father and Calvin. Why were they being so frank? Weren't they aware of the danger? But again, her anger dissolved as the gentle warmth from the tentacles flowed through her. She realized that she could move her fingers and toes with comparative freedom, and the pain was no longer so acute. "We must take this child back with us," the beast holding her said. Meg shouted at her father, "Don't leave me the way you left Charles!" With this burst of terror, a spasm of pain racked her body, and she gasped. "Stop fighting," the beast told her. "You make it worse."
"Relax."
"That's what it said," Meg cried. "Father! Calvin! Help!" The beast turned toward Calvin and Mr. Murray. "This child is in danger. You must trust us." "We have no alternative," Mr. Murray said. "Can you save her?"
"I think so."
"May I stay with her?"
"No, but you will not be far away. We feel that you are hungry, tired, that you would like to bathe and rest. And this little..."
"What is the word?"
The beast cocked its tentacles at Calvin.
"Girl," Calvin said. "This little girl needs prompt and special care. The coldness of the... what is it you call it? The black thing?"
"The black thing, yes.
The black thing burns unless it is counteracted properly." The three beasts stood around Meg, and it seemed that they were feeling into her with their softly waving tentacles. The movement of the tentacles was a rhythmic and flowing as the dance of an undersea plant, and lying there, cradled in the four strange arms, Meg, despite herself, felt a sense of security that was deeper than anything she had known since the days when she lay in her mother's arms in the old rocking chair and was sung to sleep.
With her father's help, she had been able to resist it. Now she could hold out no longer. She leaned her head against the beast's chest and realized that the gray body was covered with the softest, most delicate fur imaginable, and the fur had the same beautiful odor as the air. "I hope I don't smell awful to it," she thought. But then she knew with a deep sense of comfort that even if she did smell awful, the beast would forgive her. As the tall figure cradled her, she could feel the frigid stiffness of her body relaxing against it. This bliss could not come to her from a thing like it. It could only give pain, never relieve it. The beasts must be good. They had to be good. She sighed deeply, like a very small child. And suddenly, she was asleep. When she came to herself again, there was in the back of her mind a memory of pain, of agonizing pain. But the pain was over now, and her body was lapped in comfort. She was lying on something wonderfully soft in an enclosed chamber. It was dark. All she could see were occasional tall moving shadows, which she realized were beasts walking about. She had been stripped of her clothes, and something warm and pungent was gently being rubbed into her body. She sighed and stretched and discovered that she could stretch. She could move again. She was no longer paralyzed, and her body was bathed in waves of warmth. Her father had not saved her. The beasts had. "So, you are awake, little one," the words came gently to her ears. "What a funny little tadpole you are. Is the pain gone now?"
"All gone."
"Are you warm and alive again?"
"Yes, I'm fine," she struggled to sit up. "No, no, no, lie still, small one. You must not exert yourself as yet. We will have a fur garment for you in a moment, and then we will feed you. You must not even try to feed yourself. You must be as infant again. The black thing does not relinquish its victims willingly. Where are Father and Calvin? Have they gone back for Charles Wallace?" "They are eating and resting," the beast said. "And we are trying to learn about each other and see what is best to help you. We feel now that you are not dangerous, and that we will be allowed to help you."
"Why is it so dark in here?" Meg asked. She tried to look around, but all she could see was shadows. Nevertheless, there was a sense of openness, a feel of a gentle breeze moving lightly about that kept the darkness from being oppressive. Perplexity came to her from the beast. "What is this dark? What is this light? We do not understand. Your father and the boy, Calvin, have asked this too. They say that it is night now on our planet, and that they cannot see. They have told us that our atmosphere is what they call opaque, so that the stars are not visible. And then they were surprised that we know stars, and we know their music and the movements of their dance far better than beings like you would spend hours studying them through what you all call telescopes. We do not understand what this means, to see."
"Well, it's what things look like," Meg said helplessly. "We do not know what things look like, as you say," the beast said. "We know what things are like. It must be a very limiting thing, this seeing."
"Oh, no," Meg cried. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. What a very strange world yours must be." The beast said that such a peculiar seeming thing should be of such importance. "Try to tell me, what is this thing called light that you are able to do so little without?"
"Well, we can't see without it," Meg said, realizing that she was completely unable to explain vision in light and dark. "How can you explain sight on a world where no one has ever seen and where there is no need of eyes?"
"Well, on this planet," she fumbled, "you have a sun, don't you?"
"A most wonderful sun from which comes our warmth and the rays which give us our flowers, our food, our music, and all the things which make life and growth."
"Well," Meg said, "when we are turned toward the sun, our earth, our planet, I mean, toward our sun, we receive its light. And when we turned away from it, it is night. And if we want to see, we have to use artificial lights.
artificial lights, the beast sighed. How very complicated life on your planet must be. Later on, you must try to explain some more to me. All right, Meg promised, and yet she knew that to try to explain anything that could be seen with eyes would be impossible, because the beast in some way saw, knew, understood far more completely than she or her parents or Calvin or even Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace! She cried. What are they doing about Charles Wallace? We don't know what it's doing to him or making him do. Please, oh, please help us. Yes, yes, little one. Of course we will help you. A meeting is in session right now to study what is best to do. We have never before been able to talk to anyone who has managed to escape from a dark planet. So although your father is blaming himself for everything that has happened, we feel that he must be quite an extraordinary person to get out of Kamazots with you at all. But the little boy and I understand that he is a very special, a very important little boy. Ah, my child, you must accept that this will not be easy to go back through the black thing, back to Kamazots. I don't know. But father left him, Meg said. He's got to bring him back. He can't just abandon Charles Wallace. The beast's communication suddenly became crisp. Nobody said anything about abandoning anybody. That is not our way, but we know that just because we want something does not mean that we will get what we want, and we still do not know what to do, and we cannot allow you, in your present state, to do anything that would jeopardize us all. I can see that you wish your father to go rushing back to Kamazots, and you could probably make him do this. And then where would we be? No, you must wait until you are more calm. Now, my darling, here is a robe for you to keep you warm and comfortable. Meg felt herself being lifted again, and a soft, light garment was slipped about her. Don't worry about your little brother. The tentacles' music words were soft against her. We would never leave him behind the shadow. But for now, you must relax. You must be happy. You must get well. The gentle words, the feeling that this beast would be able to lift her no matter what she said or did, laughed Meg in warmth and peace. She felt a delicate touch of tentacle to her cheek, as tender as her mother's kiss. It is so long since my own small ones were grown and gone, the beast said. You are so tiny and vulnerable. Now I will feed you. You must eat slowly and quietly. I know that you are half starved, that you have been without food far too long, but you must not rush things or you will not get well. Something completely and indescribably and incredibly delicious was put to Meg's lips, and she swallowed gratefully. With each swallow, she felt strength returning to her body, and she realized that she had had nothing to eat since the horrible fake turkey on Kamazots, which she had barely tasted. How long ago was her mother's stew? Time no longer had any meaning. How long does night last here? She murmured sleepily. It will be day again, won't it? Hush, the beast said. Eat, small one. During the coolness which is now, we sleep, and when you awaken, there will be warmth again and many things to do. You must eat now and sleep, and I will stay with you. What should I call you, please? Meg asked. Well, now, first, try not to say any words for just a moment. Think within your own mind. Think of all the things you call people, different kinds of people. While Meg thought, the beast murmured to her gently, No. Mother is a special, a one name, and a father you have here. Not just friend, nor teacher, nor brother, nor sister. What is acquaintance? What a funny hard word. Aunt. Maybe. Yes, perhaps. That will do. And you think of such odd words about me, thing, and monster? Monster. What a horrid sort of word. I really do not think I am a monster. Beast? Will do. Aunt Beast. Aunt Beast, Meg murmured sleepily and laughed. Have I said something funny?
Aunt Beast asked in surprise. Isn't Aunt Beast all right?
Aunt Beast is lovely, Meg said. Please sing to me, Aunt Beast.
If it was possible to describe sight to Aunt Beast, it would be even more impossible to describe...
Hello, Miss Lyra?
Yes.
Hey, do you have...
Because we're interrupted, I'm going to go back to 203. If it was impossible to describe sight to Aunt Beast, it would be even more impossible to describe the singing of Aunt Beast to a human being. It was a music even more glorious than the music of the singing creatures on Uriel. It was a music more tangible than form or sight. It had essence and structure. It supported Meg more firmly than the arms of Aunt Beast. It seemed to travel with her, to sweep her aloft in the power of song, so that she was moving in glory among the stars, and for a moment she, too, felt that the words darkness and light had no meaning, and only this melody was real. Meg did not know when she fell asleep within the body of the music. When she awakened, Aunt Beast was asleep too, the softness of her furry, faceless head drooping. Night had gone and a dull gray light filled the room. But she realized now that here on this planet there was no need for color, that the grays and the browns merging into each other were not what the beasts knew, and what she herself saw was only the smallest fraction of what the planet was really like. It was she who was limited by her senses, not the blind beasts, for they must have senses of which she could not even dream. She stirred slightly, and Aunt Beast bent over her immediately. What a lovely sleep, my darling. Do you feel all right? I feel wonderful, Meg said. Aunt Beast, what is this planet called? Oh, dear, Aunt Beast sighed. I find it not easy at all to put things the way your mind shapes them. You call where you came from Camazotz. Well, it's where we came from, but it's not our planet. You can call us Ixchel, I guess, Aunt Beast told her. We share the same sun as lost Camazotz, but that, give thanks, is all we share. Are you fighting the black thing? Meg asked. Oh, yes, Aunt Beast replied. In doing that, we can never relax. We are the called according to his purpose, and whom he calls, them he also justifies. Of course we have help, and without help it would be much more difficult. Who helps you? Meg asked. Oh, dear, it is so difficult to explain things to you, small one. And I know now that it is not just because you are a child. The other two are as hard to reach into as you are. What can I tell you that will mean anything to you? Good helps us. The stars help us. Perhaps what you would call light helps us. Love helps us. Oh, my child, I cannot explain. This is something you just have to know or not know. But we look not at the things which are what you would call seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Aunt Beast, do you know Mrs. What's-It? Meg asked with a sudden flooding of hope. Mrs. What's-It? Aunt Beast was puzzled. Oh, child, your language is so utterly simple and limited that it has the effect of extreme complication. Her forearms, tentacles waving, were outflung in a gesture of helplessness. Would you like me to take you to your father and your Calvin? Oh, yes, please. Let us go, then. They are waiting for you to make plans, and we thought you would enjoy eating. That is it, you call it. Oh, yes, breakfast, together. You will be too warm in the heavy fur now. I will dress you in something lighter, and then we will go. As though Meg were a baby, Aunt Beast bathed and dressed her, and this new garment, though it was made of a pale fur, was light than the lightest summer clothes on earth. Aunt Beast put one tentacled arm about Meg's waist and led her through long, dim corridors in which she could see only shadows. And shadows of shadows, until they reached a large columned chamber. Shafts of light came in from an open skylight and converged about a huge round stone table. Here
were seated several of the great beasts and Calvin and Mr. Murray on a stone bench that circled the table. Because the beasts were so tall, even Mr. Murray's feet did not touch the ground. And lanky Calvin's long legs dangled as though he were Charles Wallace. The hall was partially enclosed by vaulted arches leading to long paved walks. There were no empty walls, no covering roofs, so that although the light was dull in comparison to Earth's sunlight, Meg had no feeling of dark or of a chill. As Aunt Beast led Meg in, Mr. Murray slid down from the bench and hurried to her, putting his arms about her tenderly. "They promised us you were all right," he said. While she had been in Aunt Beast's arms, Meg had felt safe and secure. Now her worries about Charles Wallace and her disappointment in her father's human fallibility rose like gorge in her throat. "I'm fine," she muttered, looking not at Calvin or her father, but at the beasts, for it was to them she turned now for help. It seemed to her that neither her father nor Calvin were properly concerned about Charles Wallace. "Meg," Calvin said gaily, "you've never tasted such food in your life. Come and eat." Aunt Beast lifted Meg up on the bench and sat down beside her, then heaped a plate with food, strange fruits and breads that tasted unlike anything Meg had ever eaten. Everything was dull and colorless and unappetizing to look at, and at first, even remembering the meal Aunt Beast had fed her the night before, Meg hesitated to taste, but once she had managed the first bite, she ate eagerly. It seemed that she would never have her fill again.